One of my favorite quotes is by T.E. Lawrence, and here it is. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that all was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are generous people, for they may act their dream with open eyes and make it possible. Our guest today is one of those dreamers of the day who has acted her dream with open eyes and continues to make really good things possible. Her name is Justin Winters, and she is the co-founder and executive director of One Earth, an organization whose mission is to inspire greater ambition and collaboration in the philanthropic sector and to drive urgently needed resources where they are needed most to frontline leaders and organizations working to build a just, vibrant future for all. If you're interested in hope, possibility, and real change, I invite you to stay here with me to learn more about Justin and the important work of One Earth. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. So let me tell you a little bit more about Justin. She is driven by passion for nature and is committed to democratizing climate philanthropy in order to create an inclusive and impactful movement to address the climate crisis from the ground up. Justin is going to share with us just what that looks like to drive collective action on climate change. Without question, she really is a dreamer of the day. Through One Earth, she is focused on creating a vision for the world that is possible by 2050, and that is just around the corner, trust me. One in which humanity and nature coexist and thrive together. I'm both honored to have her as a guest and extremely excited about what she has to share about one of the most amazing organizations that I have come across since the founding of Mrs. Green's World. And those of you that listen all the time know I don't say that on every show. Justin, thanks for taking the time. I'm pretty excited.
I'm so honored to join you and a little overwhelmed from that lovely introduction and just excited to talk to you.
You know what? It really is one of my favorite inspirational quotes, and I have it up on my in my office, and I've never used it on a show, but I had a coach about, I don't know, 20 years ago, and he gave me that and kept reminding me that I was a dreamer of the day, especially when things got tough being an entrepreneur. He'd say, you know, you're just going to make it possible, Gina. So I have it and I've never used it. But when I was reading about you, it's like, this is a dreamer of the day that's making really good things happen. So thank you for being here.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to borrow that quote. So I'll follow up with you later.
I will. It's so good. I can send you a screenshot. So I'd like to start our conversation with your story. First of all, everybody loves stories, but because of all the interviews I've done and the organizations I've learned about and share with our listeners, One Earth really is a wonderful story. It's important work that's almost second to none, and I can tell you some of the comments that my team made about what would happen if everybody was on board with what your vision and mission is. You made a big difference when you worked with the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. And from my perspective, you've taken a huge step to make an even bigger, more impactful, or more critical difference as one of the co-founders of One Earth. It was a big yes. It's a bold vision. So how did you get here and what's the big mission and vision? It's all about you now.
Thank you, Gina. You know, my story is very organic, if you will. I had always had a passion for nature. I had always felt very at peace and connected to the earth and spent, you know, was lucky enough and privileged enough to spend my summers outside. So I kind of had that baked in from the beginning. I mean, I think we all do, but I was very aware of it. And I was an activist in high school, but I was also, a fine artist actually. And so I had no idea that you could actually have a career working on environmental issues if you weren't a scientist. I didn't know that there was a whole realm of things that you could do. So following college, when I moved out to Los Angeles, I ended up working on Leonardo's first environmental documentary called 11th Hour. And I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a very...
I have. Pass that test.
Yeah. It is a very heavy documentary. It's
very.
It's very, yeah, it's it is 72 experts from around the world that have from different, you know, sectors and perspectives and regions are kind of telling the truth about what we're facing with climate change. And when I had the honor of at least being part of that experience, I knew right then and there that I was going to spend the rest of my life working on these issues. It was just super clear that that was the only thing I wanted to do. And so after the close of that film, I had the opportunity to work more closely with Leonardo and his, you know, his ambitions around environmental issues and climate issues. And so I was with the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation for almost 13 years, really building it from the ground up with him. And it was a really special, unique experience. It was very organic. It was very much a learning journey. It was also very creative because I was given a lot of leeway to learn and explore and develop a strategy. I also had, because of, you know, his name and his position, I had a lot of access to people all over the world who wanted to talk to me, who would actually pick up the phone if I called.
Right. That is not a bad calling card.
No, let's be honest here.
Oh, yeah, it's the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. I'll take the
call. Exactly. So, you know, I kind of ran with that and got to really build a lot of long-standing, deep relationships with activists, with indigenous leaders, with leaders of large-scale environmental institutions, with government leaders. It was just this very broad experience that allowed me to have a very particular, you know, particular kind of viewpoint of the movement and the world. And I was allowed and given the space to really question a lot of, you know, more traditional systems and structures, which I think is important in how it allowed me to kind of land on the strategy that we've built with One Earth. And I guess one of the things to speak to is, you know, over that time, we worked at building a very broad network of people across social media, 70 million people worldwide, and really crafting and honing how we would talk about environment and climate issues and how we would use that platform to hold up frontline leaders and people on the ground really doing the work. And actually another important part of that experience was everything that I learned at Bioneers, which I know is, an organization and conference and community that you love.
Near and dear close. To my heart. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So all that to say, I also had the privilege of really getting to build up a grant making strategy alongside a communication, you know, a wide, bit of communications work. And the grant making piece was really just a huge learning journey. I mean, we ended up getting $100 million out to the field to over 200 projects in over 60 different countries. And if you do that in a way that you, if you approach that with a sense of learning and listening and really, you know, treating your partners in the field with the deep respect that they deserve, you glean so much from it. And it was really, it was actually the source of all of my inspiration, because I often say this to people: when you have direct access to and relationships with and conversations with that broad network of change makers around the world, you're aware of all the people out there that are actualizing, you know, a very vibrant future that we could create. And you believe in it. It's no longer just a pipe dream. You know, and you feel it in your gut, you feel it in your heart, you know that it's possible for us to change how we live on the planet.
And what you did, you and your team, the co-founders, whoever really created this incredible movement, it's much more than an organization. To me, I wasn't just getting exuberant about, oh yeah, I'm going to be able to do another great interview. I've learned so much in my 12 years of living this, eating this, drinking this, sleeping this, and the solutions are not that obscure. They're not hard. Mm-hmm. You nailed it. I mean, even if you read Project Drawdown, and you know, I've met Paul Hawk and I've talked with him, Catherine Wilkinson talked with her, but what gives me hope is that there really are three pillars. And when scientists say we have 60 years of soil left, and many scientists say that, you're addressing that. There's so many other things. So can you just articulate what the three pillars are? Because it's really, it's the real deal.
Yes. Yeah, I would say, we know now that it is possible to solve the climate crisis. And I say that because at One Earth, we spent several years both funding and helping to develop really robust science that proves that it's possible to achieve a world of less than that critical threshold of 1.5 degree global average temperature rise. And that's 1.5 degrees Celsius
right.
temperature rise. And so the science that we funded, underpins kind of all the work that we do. And we really did that because we wanted an answer to that question. And what it also tells us is that there are three core solutions that we need to implement globally in order to solve climate change. And those three kind of solutions pathways are transitioning to 100% renewable energy, protecting and connecting and restoring 50% of the world's lands and oceans. And then the third part is transitioning our now extractive and polluting agriculture systems to regenerative, climate-friendly agriculture. So obviously there's a ton of complexity in how you actually realize those things. But we thought it was important for the world to know that science tells us that it's actually possible for us to achieve this, but we do need to move really swiftly into action.
And to articulate it from the layperson's point of view, I am the one person that went to the rainforest and came back and started a radio show because I was so freaked out by what was happening to the rainforest. But when you do a deep dive into these three pillars, yes, we need 100% renewable energy, like tomorrow, people. And yep. It solves the deforestation of the rainforest and the warming of the oceans. And when scientists say there's 60%, we have 60% of land left, soil left. That's about how many more years it's going to take to deplete the soil. So that's why I got so excited about this work and why I think it's so important for everybody to just listen, because there are solutions and we all need to be pulling in the same direction. So let's tie that into, you didn't just do that and have these three pillars. You forayed into the very complex, sometimes elusive, sometimes complicated world of philanthropy in general and how philanthropy works. So can you bring us some clarity about defining the philanthropic ecosystem for climate crisis? Who's engaging and how's that going, or are they?
So, I mean, I'd say that they're, a stat that I use a lot, and a lot of people don't know this stat, is that less than 2% of all global philanthropic dollars go to climate and environmental issues. And that is insanely low when you consider how essential it is that we protect and support the only planet and home that we have. I've been aware of that statistic, and unfortunately it has not grown substantively over the past, decade that I've been working in the philanthropic space. And an even, sadder reality is that just a fraction of those 2% of global philanthropic dollars that are going to climate and environment, just a fraction of that is actually going to climate solutions, climate action on the ground. So from my mind, there's a huge gap, but I also think that there's a huge opportunity. And so for us, the challenge has been, how do we take this very informative, almost optimistic and inspiring science that we have funded to mobilize and to galvanize folks into action around what can be done with philanthropic capital?
So here's what I say to people, and after I read this, you can see how aligned we are. I say things like Jeff Bezos should be giving all of his money to climate solutions, because if there is no workforce and there are no raw materials and there is nothing to manufacture, he's right. going to be up the creek. Not that I think Jeff Bezos will actually ever be up the creek in my lifetime, but you get you get my message. It is so strategically sensible and smart to understand that climate change takes no prisoners. It doesn't know anything about Democrats, Republicans, libertarians, coups. It's vicious and relentless and ever present. And the only way that we can work is working together. So it's just, I don't know. And when I was doing my notes, I thought 2% of all foundation funding goes to women-led environmental action. So it was even worse because women are on the bottom end of that. And I thought, well, now we have Justin, so no pressure. You could at least change it to like 3% because it is pathetic. I have another question here for you about, I have a little bit of hope now that we are going to have a new administration, a little bit. I'm not doing the happy dance yet. But do you think there is some hope that the climate change arm of the new administration will help shift it and support your work and move things forward? I mean, they should be listening to you. And I'm not just making a joke. They should be having you at their transition meetings saying, you don't have to do a lot of research. Here's three things we can do. And we're up and away. So what's your thoughts on how you can impact the new administration?
Well, we do have, because of the climate model that we funded and supported that was led by leading climate scientists, in particular Sven Teske at University Technology Sydney, because of the depth of that climate model and then the briefing that we recently released in partnership with Foundations 20, these are actually really powerful, you know, roadmaps that take the science and show what can be done with it in the context of policy and then in the context of a new administration like Biden's. Similarly, you know, we had another big piece of science that came out that is related to that second pillar around the protection and restoration of nature and the opportunity that we have to use the conservation of nature and the restoration of nature to actually solve climate change. And that was the Global Safety Net paper that came out that actually gives you that roadmap of the 50% of nature that we need to protect and restore. And so that one, that piece of science, everybody can check out at globalsafetynet.app. But similarly, that is also a really powerful tool that could potentially inform policymakers and folks in government. It's very clearly laying out what every country, what every state, what every region, the natural assets that they have that they need to protect and restore that then are a really critical piece of actually solving climate change. So though, you know, we are not, you know, our goal is really about scaling up resources and getting it to efforts on the ground, internationally and nationally. We do acknowledge that some of the science that we've ended up being involved in could actually be really impactful for policy decisions. But to be honest, I am not a policy wonk. I've learned a lot about policy and government in my years of experience through philanthropy, but I feel very much kind of not at ease. I just feel like if we end up focusing our attentions on community action, on action that is happening with indigenous groups, with local communities, and if we get them the resources that they need to make this transition and this transformation, that there's a whole scope of possibility of what can be done regardless of what is going on with our political systems. That's not to say that they're not incredibly important, but I just feel like we have this opportunity to really focus on the ground game.
I love that. I mean, you know that I would love that because it's the dreamers of the day and it's on the ground things and add youth into that. There's so much, I want to live in a place of so much hope and things like this, give it to me. So a step forward, one of the big challenges is top-down funding and you've identified it and then came up with a big, bold, innovative paradigm shift solution. So can you talk to us about Project Marketplace? Because it's really exciting and it can really help move the needle forward, if you ask me.
Thank you, Gina. So, you know, we were challenged over the past year to kind of go through, you know, how were we going to take this deep scientific global strategy and roadmap and then apply it to our ultimate goal of scaling up resources and getting it to groups on the ground. And that's why we landed on the Project Marketplace. It's still in beta mode, by the way. In 2021, we hope to launch a much more robust platform. But everybody can go visit that now from our website at oneearth.org. So the project marketplace is the very beginnings of, you know, kind of collecting some of our best partners around the world that are doing work across the three pillars of One Earth, and showcasing those efforts. And there's a really kind of unique experience for the marketplace where there's a spherical globe. So you can zoom in and zoom out and spin around the world and find projects all over the world that are making this transition happen. So as I mentioned, this is the very beginning of this, and we are going to both improve the user experience and be adding hundreds of more projects. But I think what's potentially powerful about this is that, you know, I think part of the reason that more grassroots community-led efforts have gotten relatively small pieces of funding and resources to do the work. You know, there, of course, there's larger obstacles in traditional philanthropy and larger obstacles to government scale funding. But one of the kind of issues I think out there is that though people always resonate with local stories and local action, if you fund or support just one of those smaller scale projects, it feels not necessarily that impactful to the global crisis that we're facing. So what is, in my mind, powerful about potentially about the marketplace is that you're aggregating and kind of putting together in a, into an organizing framework hundreds of different seemingly disparate efforts that when you collectively add them up, they amount to really powerful transformation and change and impact in solving climate change.
So that the person who says, oh, I can only give $50, can give that $50 and give and have a sense for the contribution that they made collectively. And to me, that is very hopeful, because sometimes people say, you know, what difference can I make? I'm not a philanthropist. Well, if you're supporting right. local efforts or global efforts or international efforts, you're a philanthropist. And the only difference between us and some of them are commas. It's like that. I'm okay yeah. with that. It's
well, here's an interesting stat for you, Gina. Of global philanthropy, when I talk about global philanthropy, 70% of global philanthropy is from individual lower donors and donations. So most of the money that goes into charitable efforts, you know, are from everyday citizens. So I feel, you know, to me, one of the things that we've always been aware of is the power of kind of collective action. And just to your point, like you can be a philanthropist with $5, you know, the same way that you can be a philanthropist if you have a much bigger bank account and can put millions, if not billions, towards some of these efforts. So we're not quite yet there with the marketplace, but our ultimate goal is to make that experience the same for every level of donor.
So we'll be talking again. I know we will anyway, and we'll have no internet problems. So it's like when it's a little bit farther along, and I don't want to go much longer in the show without saying, please say hello to Edward Bell and Carl Burkhart, because I spent a long time talking to them before this was all launched because of a podcast I did about the climate change at the nexus of the economy. So just give my best to them. So can you just elaborate a little more, because I think we kind of glossed over it, and about the global safety net, because I think that's really, really important. And I think it bears just a little bit more explanation in terms of the work that you're doing.
Sure. So, you know, for that second pillar of action that we need to do to achieve, to solve climate change, essentially, and to ensure that we have a viable planet going forward, we supported a scientific effort called the Global Safety Net, which was published in Science Advances in early September. And then we also built, you know, at the same time and launched an interactive data tool with Google Earth that actually makes that science, you know, tangible and visible, so that people can log on and understand what the roadmap of nature is in their country, in their state, that needs to be protected and restored to solve climate change. And to give that a little bit more explanation, you know, not obviously the roadmap of what intact lands are left and the roadmap of what biodiversity has the deepest carbon stores. All of that varies greatly because there's so much, you know, biodiversity around the world, and every landscape is different. So it's not like, you know, the United States needs to protect 50% and same thing as India. All of these countries and regions have a very different roadmap. And you have to weave together both an understanding of the deep carbon stores of nature, and then also a deeper understanding of biodiversity and ecosystems and what's left intact, where are there opportunities for restoration. So all that being said, this is just the first version of the Global Safety Net, and we're working to do a much, you know, even higher resolution version of this. But I think what could potentially be really powerful about this as it evolves is that it makes it, you know, very clear. If you take a look at the Global Safety Net in your state, for example, you can connect and understand the roadmap of nature that needs to be protected and restored. And ultimately, you'll be able to find projects that are directly helping to build and create that Global Safety Net in your local region. While at the same time, you may have a really strong relationship, like you mentioned, to the rainforest. So you could zoom over to the rainforest, say in Ecuador, and look at the roadmap of nature that needs to be protected and restored there, and you could support efforts as well. This starts to create a much better sense of, you know, both your local environment, but also our global environment, and starts to potentially create a sense of community and collective effort towards actually building and restoring that global safety net of nature.
And to me, it celebrates the critical part that biodiversity plays and gets us ready. Most of the scientists that I'm talking to these days, they don't talk about climate adaptation and mitigation anymore. They're talking about resilience because of the point we're at. So this is about that. And the other part I read in prepping for the show was, and I am a geek about certain things, and I'm really a geek about Google Earth, because I heard a presentation at Bioneers by a woman that I think was the head of Google Earth. I think she was, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So you did have a partnership where you do with them. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because it's all connected.
Yes. So I think you're probably speaking about Rebecca Moore.
Yes, that's her.
Who has spoken at Bioneers several times, but we worked very closely with her team at Google Earth, and it was a lot of their data and their technology capability that made the Global Safety Net even possible to build and do, or actually to visualize. That is kind of the model of how we work. You know, we're not interested at One Earth in building a giant institution. We're much more about working collaboratively with the leading experts and leaders around the world, and kind of, you know, pairing up on key pieces of science or work that need to get done and doing that together. So I think the Google Earth partnership just kind of speaks to that.
So, you know, it's almost like we set this up and we rehearsed, and then you said, well, I'll say this, and then that'll cue you to say that. And trust me, everyone, that never happens at Mrs. Green's World. We never rehearse. We try not to talk too much about the show off the air. But two more questions that I had for you. And one, it's really a perfect segue because of the technology piece of this. And I want to pick your brain and get your thoughts on two more topics. One of them is the sense of what youth bring to this conversation. Because if you're doing things in apps and with technology and connecting, you're talking like my 19-month-old granddaughter knows how to find Spotify on my phone. And her mother doesn't like me to tell that to people because I'm the one that gives her the phone. Her mother and father don't want her on the phone. But so technology is the future when it comes to youth. What are you seeing in the youth space? And I don't mean, you know, the big names like Gretchen, that's clear. But when you're talking about grassroots, frontline movements, are you excited about what you're seeing? Are you encouraged? And how is it impacting philanthropy? And I know those are very two different questions.
No, they're very related. I would say that what gives me hope about the youth movement is that you're looking at a group, a generation of kids, almost adults, who are, they're awake. They know that this problem exists. They know that the solutions exist, and they are willing to fight to create the future that they deserve, frankly. And so to me, just the jumpstart of A, being awake, being motivated, really stirring the pot and challenging, older generations that, frankly, haven't done enough. And, challenging systems that are archaic and need to be essentially redesigned to be more equitable, to be, more equitable both to all people and to the earth, frankly. So to me, they're an essential piece of the movement that is really asking for change, and they're asking for transformation, and they're asking for us to move quickly. And the fact is that the science tells us that we can actually get this done quickly. So we really, the only thing that's in our way is ourselves.
Yeah. And I'm going to say to people, yeah, there's three pillars. Here's the newsflash. And I'm not saying that in any pithy way. It's like, this is it. And we do have the solutions, and it's going to cost money. What's the other side of that coin? Total devastation of the planet. And it's, yeah, that is not hyperbole at all. And you and I both know it. So that's youth. And, another shout out to Bioneers. I'm going to have to send this podcast to Nina. But when you go there and you hear some 16-year-old girl who is from the indigenous land where Bioneers is held, and she is giving us hell, kind of, in a very nice way, I have a lot of hope. And I'm thinking, you know what I was doing at 16? Not that. Yep. Okay. The second one is, it's probably, if I had to pick one issue that I would love to see change the most, it's raising the voices of women in the climate change conversation. A really good friend of mine is Diana Liverman from the University of Arizona. And she's the one at a dinner, we were at dinner one night, and she talked about the barriers to women climate scientists in some countries having their work published because of the bias against women. And then she introduced me to Catherine Wilkinson from Drawdown, who just kind of like tore the lid off it. She'll talk about it up one side and down the other. And I got to drive back from Phoenix to Tucson with her and then went to a breakfast. And it is a problem to me because so much important work is done by women climate scientists. And when you talked about the statistic about 2% of all foundation money goes to women-led environmental activities, do you...
It's actually 0.2%.
I just looked at it. That is 0.2% people. So there's 0.2, which is nothing. And it's very, very upsetting. Is that something that you think we can change the whole, and I say this with a very stereotypical acknowledgement, the white man rule syndrome, I'm so tired of it. And I will die fighting it because we need to break down those paradigms. So do you have a sense of any strong, powerful rumblings that women are getting more play, more acknowledgement, more money? What's your take on that?
I'd say over the past 2 years, I think the space has completely changed.
Yay!
I do not have the metrics yet to back that up, but when I just take a temperature check of the conversations that are happening, the leaders that are emerging, the news of larger scale foundations and how they're restructuring their strategies and their approaches, I really do think that we're in a moment. I know it feels very chaotic and it feels like the crises we're facing on so many fronts are overwhelming, but part of the value of disruption and some of the things that we're facing is that they crack open the system and they allow new things and new ways of being to start, emerging and to become, we want those things to become the status quo. And I see that happening. And it gives me a lot of hope to see collectively so many people responding to that. And it's hard to remember or see that that is happening when there's so many dark things happening at the same time. But I really do feel like there's tremendous change on the horizon.
I do too. And I read, there's a man named Reverend Bernard Beckwith, Michael Bernard Beckwith from Agape in LA. And he's a spiritual leader. I don't know. He's the whole enchilada. And he sends words of inspiration out every day, which I read. And that's what he says every day. Every day, Justin, he says, we're creating a new paradigm. Step up and help be a part of what you wanted to look at. And that gives me hope. He says it in very many different ways, but it's like, yeah, you're either part of the solution or part of the problem. And with my last breath, I will be part of the solution. I can tell you that. So,
no, thank you, Gina, for doing that work. I mean, one thing to just put out there, and maybe this is, you know, from my more kind of artistic roots, and maybe it's spiritual roots too, but I think, you know, humans have a huge capacity for creativity and for manifesting things that they imagine. So if there's anything that I would ask listeners to do, it's not that you don't want to take specific direct action. Of course you do. But I also want you to take a minute to imagine a whole, just, thriving world. To imagine what that looks like, to imagine, you know, us having protected and restored vast swaths of nature, to imagine communities much more connected to each other and working in tandem, and being kind and compassionate to each other and supportive of things both personally and things within their community that they need to change. You know, I want you to imagine clean air and clean water and everybody having access to electricity and everybody having access to a good education, regardless of your skin color, regardless of your income level. You need to imagine the world that you want, because we are so collectively powerful in what we manifest. And so much of what we're being thrown right now is a vision of a very dark world. And there is something, there's an alternate to that, and you can play an active role in creating it.
And we have to go there. I feel like cheering for what you said, and I am not kidding. It's like, this is about hope and possibility and change. And when I go to the dark side, I don't spend very much time there because I don't like it. And I just come back and say, what are we going to do to make a difference today with our team and the people that we know and our voices getting out there? And that was eloquent and beautiful and powerful. And I invite everybody who's listening to literally press pause on whatever gizmo you're listening on, play it back, and listen to what Justin said. That's what's going to help the dream work. It's going to help the dream become the reality, and just take the time to rewind and play it again and maybe save the clip when the dark side starts coming in over you, because sometimes it does. So yeah. I want to remind everybody, if you don't have anything else that you wish I had asked you, Justin, which you can do, that any websites that we mention or links will be in the show notes. So if you're listening to this while you're driving, don't worry about jotting it down. Kelly does a great job of putting those links in. And is there anything else? I can't imagine that you have anything else to say after that eloquent summation.
I do. I have one more thing.
Okay, you
share.
Go, girl. So, I love it.
So another thing that we launched this year was a new framework for the world that is really based on, you know, the planet, the earth systems that sustain all of life. And it is a bioregional map of the world. So if you go on our website, under the explore section, you can find bioregions, and there you can see the spherical globe that will, you can explore, you can move it around, you can zoom in, you can zoom out. But most importantly, I just would invite you and bear with us since it's kind of the beta version of this experience, but find the bioregion that you live in, read about it, start to understand the landscape that you exist within, and the nature around you, and then maybe check back with Gina and with me the next time we talk, because we'll have a much more rich experience and a much more cohesive way for you to take action.
I'm so glad I asked you that. And it's really so important, because I had a conversation with a really good friend and a donor, and I got really annoyed with him, and he knew it. And he said, you know, I'm listening to this great podcast, Gina, and I think you'll love it. And I think is her name Christina Figuera? I'm sure.
Yes. Figueras.
And I said, oh yeah, well, I know her. I said something like that because I'm like, what are you telling me about somebody else's podcast? And I do love it. It's Outrage Optimism, and they have some great guests. But his point was, he said, you know what's wrong with the movement, the climate change movement? It's not integrated. And I was like, Bob, how long have you been my friend? I've been saying that for 12 years. And One Earth is integrating. You're integrating. It's not silos. It's taking all that you know, all the science that's out there, and putting it into a plan that's possible with three pillars. So I said to him, please don't ever tell me that's your favorite podcast again, because that would be like terminating the friendship. But he does love my podcast. But it, you know, my point was, this is why I'm excited about the work you're doing. And I have some last words, and you probably don't know this, Justin, but one of the joys I have of doing this show is that I get to have the last word. And it comes from my mother, who used to say, oh, Regina Mary, she always has to have the last word. And finally, I created a podcast so that I would. So just bear with me.
Well
and
done.
I know. It's like my mom would be so proud of me. She said, someday, not when I was 16, she said, that will hold you in good stead. And she was right. So if I had a magic wand, this is what I thought about, or a single wish from that genie in the bottle, which I do wish I had some days, I would wish that everyone who listens to this podcast goes spend some time on the One Earth website, learn what they are about and why it matters ever so much to you and me and everybody we love, and then share the podcast and their website, because that's what creates movements. That's how movements are made. That's how we reach our tipping point. That's what resilience looks like. Understand at a very deep level that we need One Earth. We need their message. Understand that they have one purpose in mind. One, preservation of this great planet of ours. If you can help support their mission in any way, awesome, including financially. Be that dreamer of the day. Act with open eyes and make missions possible. Make their mission become a reality. So as for me, I'm feeling pretty grateful about quite a few things these days. In a time when so many people have challenges, I do my gratitude list every day. Even in a COVID world, but when it comes to the climate crisis, I do sometimes panic. I get fearful. I feel hopeless. And then I remember that I'm part of the solution. And what I want all of you to remember is you are too. By spreading the word and the work about One Earth and other things that we share, and by getting to spend some time learning from someone like Justin Winters, think about what she said about what we should be imagining. All seems right about the world again. Thank you, Justin, from my very green heart for showing up in my world and for the work you do and that your team is doing on all of our behalf. And as always, my final thanks is to you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. Stay safe, wear a mask, and help me spread the good green word by sharing this podcast with someone you care about. So, Justin, thank you. We overcame some really big obstacles, but we made it happen.
Thank you, Gina. It's such an honor to talk to you. So inspiring. And thank you to your audience for listening in.
Right back at you. Thank you. And I want to thank our sound engineer, Dave Lebrecht, for being a saint and staying with us. And I rarely do that on the air, but without him, there would be no me. So thank you, Justin. And give my love to the team and my appreciation to everyone.
I will, for sure. Thank you so much, Gina.